Today at Reader's Corner, David Brooks, author of The Road to Character. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Every once in a while, you come across individuals who make you feel better just for having encountered them. As today's guest David Brooks puts it, they seem deeply good. They listen well. They make you feel funny and valued. They are not thinking about what wonderful work they are doing. They are not thinking about themselves at all. Mr. Brooks drew inspiration from these encounters to write a best-selling book, The Road to Character. It's now out in paperback. In the book, Mr. Brooks challenges us to pay more attention to virtues that exist at the core of our being, like kindness, bravery, honesty, or faithfulness. And he delves into the lives of 10 historical figures to explore character in some depth and how it can serve as a compass for life. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with David Brooks. He visited Boise last fall as the featured speaker at the Boise State Distinguished Lecture Series, and The Road to Character was our campus read this past academic year. Mr. Brooks will be returning to Idaho later this month for the Sun Valley Writers Conference, which this year runs June 30th to July 3rd and is built around the theme, A Question of Character. The conference is sold out, but there is free lawn seating for Mr. Brooks' talk at the Sun Valley Pavilion. Details and tickets are available online at svwc.com. David Brooks is an op-ed columnist for the New York Times and appears regularly on PBS NewsHour, NPR's All Things Considered, and NBC's Meet the Press. He teaches at Yale University and is a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. Mr. Brooks joins us today by phone for this interview. David Brooks, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Great to be with you.
Well, David, we started out mentioning the fact that you have steered your readers toward good character by highlighting 10 of the world's great thinkers and leaders, from Francis Perkins to Dwight Eisenhower and on to Augustine. What do we gain by looking at these examples? Why did you choose to write a book about character in that sense?
Well, I believe, and have read, I didn't make this up, that there are four levels of happiness. There's material happiness, which is what you get when you have some nice clothing or a nice car or something like that. And then there's status happiness, when you like win a victory, get a little famous, or you achieve some career success. But then there's two other kinds of happiness. There's generativity, which is the pleasure you get from giving back to your community. And then the highest is transcendence, when you're connected to some ideal, some infinite love, and you're living a life that seems true. And I think, you know, we're pretty good naturally at levels one and two, but we got to be struggling, be taught to achieve level three and four. And so I had achieved more career success, for example, in my own life than I imagined I would, but I still hadn't achieved level three and four. I hadn't been one of those people who radiates inner light. And I just wanted to figure out how you get there and what do you do to get there. And so I tried to learn from these individuals just how having a good character can give you a deep inner peace and hopefully the highest form of happiness and joy.
So I guess one of the ways you help us understand what you're getting at here is at the very beginning of your book, where you talk about the resume virtues and the eulogy virtues. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the resume virtues are the things that make you good at your job, whether you're going to be a good dentist or a lawyer or a nurse or a teacher. And the eulogy virtues are the things they say about you after you're dead, whether you're honest, courageous, bold, capable of great love. And I think we all know the eulogy virtues are more important than the resume virtues. We all want to be remembered for who we are and not just how we do at our job. But I think we happen to live in a culture that emphasizes the resume ones, and certainly our school systems. And, you know, I teach college too, and our educational system puts a lot of emphasis on how you're going to get a good career, how you're going to make some money, have some financial stability. But everyone, and my students especially, are super hungry to be good people and to know how to be good people. But they haven't been given sometimes the vocabulary to figure out how to do that. They're a lot more clear when thinking about their career than when thinking about their character. So it's not as if we're bad people. I think in our culture, we're just sort of morally inarticulate. And so a lot of what I try to do in the book is look at people who really took their inner life and their inner development very seriously and just sort of stop and try to name some of the things that we all seek to do and all want to do.
I guess I'm reminded just recently, one prominent American was challenged to come up with how he made sacrifices in his younger life. And I think the example he used was creating jobs for people. And that certainly seems to fall in the category of the resume virtue as opposed to the eulogy virtue.
Yeah, and that particular individual, we're talking about Donald Trump, of course.
right.
You know, I thought at the Republican National Convention, some of the best speeches were given by his kids. But when they talked about Dad, they talked about visiting him on a work site. It was always in some work context. And I won't get political here, but there are a lot of people in the world where work has sort of taken over their life and they get their measure from how they do at work. Whereas the people in my book, believe me, they were all successful. Dwight Eisenhower's president of the United States. Dorothy Day founded a great service organization for the poor. So they had a measure of career accomplishment. But the central drama of their lives was not the external drama for success. It was the internal drama to be good. And they really took that seriously. And one of the things they did is they just said, you know, what's my greatest weakness? Where's my sin? What do I do? And for Dwight Eisenhower, he tended to get angry a lot. For Dorothy Day, she was just sort of scattered in her and desperate for love and didn't always behave with integrity. And so they said, well, I'm going to try to be strongest in my weakest spot. I'm going to try to work on my sin and confront my sin. And on days when they were good, when they weren't lazy or they weren't vain or they weren't angry, then those were days of great triumph. On days when they succumbed and were weak, those were days of sadness. And so, but it was their struggle was internal, and they really cared about that core piece of themselves, which was their integrity.
There was at one point in academic history, if I can call it that, a study of national character as opposed to your vignettes, small biographies of these people who you feel have achieved this character designation. And you refer to the big me culture. And I just wonder if your work doesn't lead to something even larger at some point where we're really talking about, not that we want to, at least if it's on the resume virtues instead of the eulogy virtues, but are we talking about a national character issue as well as just a collection of people who happen to have their own approach to character?
Yeah, of course, we're all shaped by all sorts of information coming to our heads at different levels. There's information that comes in from thousands and millions of years ago, which we call genetic. And then there's information that comes in from centuries ago, we call culture. And then from our own nation, which is history, and then our own family, and then our own individual experience. So we're an amalgam of all these different influences. And I'd say we're, you know, as Americans say, we're influenced by two things. One, the long flow of American history. I'm really struck by, you know, Alexis de Tocqueville came here in the 1830s. And the America he describes back then is still basically the America we have now. We're a country of people who, you know, when the first Puritan settlers came to America, they decided they saw such an abundance on the continent. They decided they could get, you know, God's plans for humanity would be completed here, and B, that they could get really rich in the process. And so we Americans have been very materialistic, but also very spiritually striving at the same time. And I think a lot of those patterns still exist in America today, so we're shaped by that. But then there's the contemporary culture, which is just of the last 20 or 30 years. And I'd say one of the features of that culture is much greater levels of narcissism, where, you know, the every kid gets a trophy syndrome, the high self-esteem syndrome. They have this thing called the narcissism test, where they give people a bunch of statements and they say, does this apply to you? And there are statements like, I find it easy to manipulate people because I'm so extraordinary, or somebody should write a biography of me. And in that case, the median narcissism score has gone up 30% in the last 20 years. So we're extremely pleased with ourselves these days. You know, in math performance, we rank 25th in the world in math. But if you ask people, are you really good at math? We rank number one in the world in thinking we're really good at math. And so I do think we're formed by the deep roots of American culture, but we're also formed by contemporary culture, which has a lot of good sides to it. But on the downside, I think it's become a much more self-absorbed and narcissistic culture.
Well, for those of us in higher education, as we get ready to welcome a new class of entering freshmen, the millennial generation is upon us, and you do begin to wonder just whether or not that brings a wholly different approach to educating young people than we may have resorted to in the past.
Yeah, I think every generation is different. I think this generation in some ways is just way more impressive than people my generation. I'm sort of the tail end of the baby boomer generation. And some of the students I meet are just amazing in what they've done in their short lives. They're very community-oriented. They're ideal-oriented. But I guess the two things I find, first, that they're living in such a competitive world that they, some of them just don't have time to focus on the things that matter most. And I find my students, they undervalue friendship. They spend so much time in student activities and in classes and in partying. They don't hang out with their friends as much as I think they should. I tell them when you're going to get out of college, there'll be periods of loneliness, periods of unemployment, periods of romantic breakup. You're going to need your friends. And so you should really make some good friendships while in school. And that's part of our culture of emphasizing career and not enough the things that really matter. The second thing I find all around the country is, and I hear this from long-term faculty, is greater levels of emotional fragility in today's students. And I really don't know why that is, but there's a lot more fear, there's insecurity. I think there's a lot of conditional love they're surrounded by, and so they're afraid they're going to lose their loving relationships if they don't succeed. And so there's some fragility in this generation, too. I think every generation has the things they do really well. This generation is very tolerant, very open, but some things they don't do as well. And the final thing I'll say is, as people are trying to teach young people in higher ed, you know, with online courses, transmitting knowledge for a university is no longer enough. You can get data from online, from a computer. But one of the things universities, I think, should be doing is a lot more community, a lot more values, a lot more immediate contact between faculty and students. Just, you know, the way the real values gets communicated is not through a sermon or even a radio show. It's through the daily contact with people and seeing how they act and seeing how they act well and how they act badly. And so I think universities have to get, frankly, a lot more moralistic and take advantage of physical proximity to become a lot closer between faculty and students.
You're listening to Reader's Corner, and I'm talking today with David Brooks, author of the bestseller, The Road to Character. Well, one of the things we hope to do with your book, The Road to Character, as our campus read, is help our students better understand those who have come before them, those who have served as role models, heroes. And that brings me to General George Marshall. You've included him as one of the 10 people of good character in your book. And what you talk about in regard to his own education at VMI is how they taught him a sense of reverence. I wonder if you could comment on that in the context of the fact that thousands of students are going to be reading your book as it becomes a campus read all over the country, and they're going to be taking away the same kind of messages you've imparted here in the book.
Yeah, reverence is becoming a big word for me. I think morality, all of proper behavior, requires a sense of reverence, some amazing respect either for an institution or for an idea or a cause or even, you know, the soul of another person, where you really step back humbly and see the depth of and the truth of that idea or cause or person, and you try to live up to that. And so what Marshall did, he was really a bad student. All the people in my book by age 20 were very unimpressive, but by 70, they were kind of amazing. So this was something they did themselves. They weren't just born with a naturally great disposition. And Marshall was a very unimpressive young man. He was shy, he was scared, he was a bad student. But when he got to military school, he learned reverence for the way the Army did things, for the marching, for the polish, for the self-sacrifice, for the code of duty, honor, and courage. And his sin was that he was insecure, but also super ambitious. And he spent his career with a rule that he would not advocate for himself. He would never put himself above the Army or above country. And, you know, my favorite Marshall story is when he's, it's 1943 or so, and Franklin Roosevelt is trying to name the officer who's going to be in running Operation Overlord, the D-Day invasion. And Marshall really badly wants the job, but he won't ask for it. He won't campaign for it because that's his code. I'm not going to be self-interested. I'm going to do what's good for the good of the country. And one day, Roosevelt calls Marshall into the Oval Office and says, would you like the Operation Overlord job? And Marshall could have just said yes, but instead he said, well, this is not about my own personal ambitions. You do whatever is right for you and the country. And Roosevelt asked him four times, and four times Marshall said, no, this is not about me. This is about the country. And Roosevelt took the opportunity to give the job to Eisenhower so he could keep Marshall close to him in the White House. And Marshall was upset. He lost the big promotion, battlefield promotion he'd been dreaming of. But he wouldn't be Marshall unless he lived by that code. And he really was one of the most admired and revered people of the 20th century. And it's because of his reverence for the ideal of service and military service.
Well, while we're in the military, let's talk a little bit about President Eisenhower. What do we learn from Eisenhower's life?
That sincerity is not always a good thing. You know, we all want to be sincere and true to ourselves. But, you know, that's complicated because sometimes ourselves are very imperfect. And if we're true to ourselves, then we're just satisfied in our own mediocrity. And Eisenhower was a guy who was angry a lot of the time and depressed a lot of the time and frustrated a lot of the time. He had this real big temper, and his staff came to know and fear it. But he knew he couldn't lead from a position of anger and temper and hatred. He needed to lead from, especially in wartime and then as president, from a position of optimism and cheerfulness. And so he really forced himself to become an optimistic, cheerful personality. And some of the things he did were kind of artificial. Like if he hated somebody, he'd write their name over and over again on a piece of paper and rip it up and throw it in the garbage can. And that was his way of purging anger. But he created a great persona, a great leadership persona, which encouraged people. When if he just stayed the way he was naturally, he wouldn't have been an inspiring leader at all. And he became quite an underestimated figure in American history.
Well, speaking of underestimated and perhaps even unknown, Dorothy Day comes to mind. I don't think she's going to resonate with our listeners the way Dwight Eisenhower does because he was a former president. But certainly she showed us how to build great character. Tell us who she was and how that happened.
Yeah, it's funny, and I should mention, she wrote a book called The Long Loneliness, which is a very beautiful book, which I highly recommend to people. And it's really a memoir and a spiritual memoir. She grew up in San Francisco and Chicago and then decided to become a sort of a beatnik, an early hippie back in the 19-teens and 20s in New York. But she was living a very disorganized life, drinking a lot, carousing a lot, a couple abortions, a couple suicide attempts. And it was a life that made her ashamed. But then when her daughter was born, she was so grateful for the birth of her daughter, and she was a single mom, that she became religious and she became Catholic. And from that moment at age, say, 30 till nearly, I think she died nearly 90, she not only served the poor, she embraced poverty and lived among the poor. She created a radical newspaper, and then she created soup kitchens and homeless shelters. And she was living all her life, a very hard life, really, with the homeless. And there was a lot of mental instability among the people she was living with. There was a lot of ingratitude. But she embraced poverty. She thought that God wants us to live extremely simple life. No salary, just getting by day, borrowing clothing to live in. But she had a great rectitude and a sternness. And she became, and I think she's going to become a saint before too long, she became widely admired. And I must say, my students, when I assign her book, they are so riveted by her because she's, first of all, it's a life of real service. But she's also so emotional. She's really very relational, and her passions just fly out in all directions. And really, she really believed in sharing bread and creating situations where people ate together. And she was usually the one serving the bread, but allowing others to sit, even homeless people, people with mental disabilities, to sit and have communion with one another. And that was really her religious mission. If you go on YouTube and you type her in, you can find some of the late interviews she did. And she has a great force of character. And she's been a very inspiring person for people to come to meet her.
Could you comment on the role that literature played in her life? I think wisdom literature is the term that you used. Tell us about that. And how's that changed as far as today is concerned?
Yeah, she read novels with the fervent belief that they contain the magic keys to the kingdom of life, that hidden in the great books are real truths. And she loved Dostoevsky in particular. She loved Tolstoy. And so when she read novels, it was like almost religious or wisdom literature for her. And she took her reading very seriously. And I'm not sure we today have as much faith in the power of art or the power of literature. But I personally think she was right, that one of the things reading a great book can do, or looking at a great painting or listening to a great piece of music, is that it widens your repertoire of emotions. It teaches you new things to feel. It refines the way you feel. I'm a believer, as Day was, and as another of my characters, Augustine, was. We think of ourselves as thinking creatures primarily, as cognitive creatures, but really we're emotional and desiring creatures, foremost and foremost. And one of the things I think we can do as educators is educate the emotions, give people a wider range of emotions, help people understand the emotions that are riling inside them. And so she read literature not to educate her mind about how to do stuff, but she read literature in order to know how to feel well. And that, if you're going to be in any sort of loving relationship, feeling well is actually a great skill, and it doesn't come naturally.
Boy, you know, that really resonated with me as I read your book, and it's the reason why I asked you that question. In higher education today, with all of this pressure from employers to produce graduates who are more technically trained, it's tough to keep literature in the curriculum, in the core curriculum. And I think you've done a great job of making the point here.
If I could just say one point on that, I mean, even if you're at a workplace or a family, everything depends on relationships and whether you're able to build relationships and sustain relationships and understand what other people are feeling and thinking. And I think if you haven't read some amount of literature, it's just a lot harder to be good at that.
I'm Bob Kustra, host of Reader's Corner, and my guest is David Brooks, a New York Times columnist and author of The Road to Character. Well, I hear that all the time from CEOs. You know, the CEO will tell you that they value the liberal arts and what it brings to the job. It's the human resource management department that's doing the hiring that sometimes overlooks those aspects of a graduate's background and focuses instead on the technical stuff.
Yeah, and I would say if you can write well in any organization, you're going to have a valued role because it's a rare skill.
Exactly.
To communicate clearly.
Right.
And if you go through college without writing too many papers, that'll be hard.
Mm-hmm. So given how many of your characters in this book had these major flaws that they overcame, and that's, of course, the reason why they got into your book, have you had any pushback or any criticism from people about choosing some characters? I mean, you just rattled off a number of things that Dorothy Day did in her life that I'm sure people wouldn't want to emulate. Obviously, she overcame them, and she's probably going to be a saint someday, as you said. But did you get any flack?
I don't think so. I mean, most people are pretty flawed. So
right.
Anybody with some maturity knows, yeah, I've got some flaws and I've done some things I regret,
right.
Too. And so that's what makes human life interesting is that, but the people who can triumph over their flaws are the people who inspire us. There are paragraphs in the book about investigating things like what suffering does for us and what love does for us. But we learn from other people and we learn from the examples of other people. And so I put the biographies in there. Flaws and all, because we see how they were struggling. And as I said, at 23, 24, none of them would have seemed particularly impressive. And yet, by an act of conscious will, they paid attention to not what they accomplished, but who they were. I do think generally people get better at living as they get older. I saw a great interview with Art Garfunkel, actually, on TV on one of the CBS shows. And he said, when you get older, you get out of your own way. And he meant by that when we're young, we're so often so self-absorbed or wondering how are people going to perceive us that we create a lot of problems for ourselves. And as you get older, I think you care a little less about what others are thinking. You develop an internal criteria for how am I doing? You can make that decision on your own. You don't need external validation quite as much. And you get out of your own way and life gets a little better. And the characters in my book certainly experience that.
Well, another one in your book that certainly had his flaws but went down in history as one of the great civil rights leaders, even though he's not as well known as Martin Luther King, obviously, Bayard Rustin. Tell us about Bayard Rustin's contributions and his flaws.
Yeah, he was an African-American man who actually decided in World War II he was a pacifist, so he'd go to jail rather than serve in the army. He fervently believed in pacifism. And when he was in jail, it was a segregated jail, and so he decided he would integrate it. And so if there was a white spot in the dining hall, he sat in the white spot. And if there was a white bathroom, he'd go to the white bathroom. And he endured a lot of beatings for this and endured a lot of pain and a lot of suffering. But he was going to pursue the cause of civil rights. But, you know, he was also driven by, he was very eloquent, and he was driven by ego. And so he got carried away with his own role in the civil rights movement. He was a gay man who was, frankly, using other people quite a lot intimately. And he was with a partner, but he was often promiscuous and cheating on that partner in ways that were selfish. And so he had two strikes against him in mid-century 20th century America. He was both gay and black. And his egotism really led to a series of scandals that really forced him from being the front ranks of the civil rights movement to being a backstage player. And he finally said, okay, I accept that role. I'll be a backstage player. I'll support Martin Luther King. I'll teach him about nonviolence. I'll write some of his books and speeches. And it won't be about me. I won't be up on stage. And so he had to endure a lot of humility. And then finally made it up on stage when he and Philip Randolph organized the March on Washington in 1964. And at that point, he was the MC of the march, and he finally got his moment in the sun. But he had to endure many years of silence and humility to get there.
You close your book with a discussion of the humility code. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, the book really is centered around humility and what virtues humility makes possible. And to me, humility is not thinking lowly of yourself. It's accurate self-awareness from a distance. And that is to say, it's the ability to step outside yourself, see yourself from the broadest possible perspective, and be really honest about what your strengths and what your weaknesses are. And pride is the greatest vice because that's what blinds you to yourself. It's what makes us puff up and be arrogant and also fragile. And so a lot of my characters, they had a lot of self-confidence, and they knew their own abilities, but they also could see themselves very honestly, and they didn't lie to themselves. And so the Humility Code is a series of propositions based on the virtue of humility and how to lead a good life from them. And one of them is that, you know, the big drama of our life is the internal struggle to make the central piece of our life a little better day by day. And another is that none of us can be redeemed by ourselves. We all rely on assistance from outside, whether it's from family giving us support or friends giving us advice or community giving us standards to live by. And humility means putting yourself in really a modest position before the institutions you're born into and trying to empty yourself and serve them.
This book could have been 1,000 pages long. You could have chosen another 10 people easily, I'm sure, from history across the world. It suggests there could be a second edition to this, and maybe not. But I guess I'm wondering, if you had to write a book like this all over again, but choosing people of the hour, so to speak, those among us today, any thoughts on who those might be?
Yeah, I have some people, you know, that I admire today who are not perfect, but I find them very inspiring. There's a doctor named Atul Gawande who writes books, and I don't know him well, but he wrote a book recently called Being Mortal. And in his writing, he is a surgeon, but he shows great humility before the complexity of the human body. And he says, when we operate, we really don't always know what's going to happen with the body because it's so complicated. And we just have to be open to surprises, and we can never fall for the illusion that we think we know what we're doing. So he operates a very daring craft, surgery, from a position of deep humility. And I admire the way he handles that. There's a woman who's now our UN ambassador named Samantha Power, who has kept, you know, in every job there's a lot of compromises involved, especially when you're part of a team. But she's managed to be practical, but also bring passion and bring moral passion. And one of the things that we tend to drift into in the middle of our careers is we lose a sense of the moral passion that drove us in the first place. It gets buried in the day-to-day mundane realities. And we don't look at the world through a moral lens. We tend to look at it through a utilitarian lens, a practical lens, which is what's going to work for me right now. But I think Samantha looks at the world problems through a moral lens and sort of drives all of her relationships through that moral sensibility. And it's nice to see someone who is so deeply moral from morning to noon to night.
Well, David, we haven't even gotten through all the list that's in your book, so I would urge my listeners to please get a copy of The Road to Character by David Brooks. Thank you so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
It's been a pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with David Brooks. Next week, Edward Alden, author of Failure to Adjust, How Americans Got Left Behind in the Global Economy. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Sherry Squires. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner. If you missed some of our previous interviews, including my conversation with Noah Eisenberg about his new book, We'll Always Have Casablanca, you can find them on our website, that's BoiseStatePublicRadio.org, or download our free app from Google Play or the App Store to listen to previous shows anytime.